Welcome back to Tag Team, the Pokemon Trading Card Games premier podcasting trio. My name is JW Kriwal. Here with me, Andrew Mahone, and we're here to talk about some of the testing that we had done with the post-rotation. We teased it last week about all the stuff that we were testing and trying out and the new decks, new archetypes, and actually a lot of old decks and old archetypes that we have been playing. But before we get into that, Andrew, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. This is a very special episode for those of you that can see us. We are broadcasting from Tricky Jim Studios, and this is the very first time that we've ever had a tag team podcast that we're streaming live on Tricky Jim from Tricky Jim Studios. And this is the second time in a couple of weeks that you've been able to make the trip over from Columbus to join me on stream for some tabletop
testing.
Well,
don't get too big of a head because I am double dipping a little bit. I'm seeing our tax guy,
AJ,
tomorrow.
Yeah.
For a little bit of, you know, filing.
Yes.
So it's not just for you. I just want to make that 100% clear.
You're here on business.
Yeah, I'm standing on business for sure.
Okay. You're here for business. Yeah. I was texting AJ. Hopefully he gets back to me. I know. I was trying to get in with him for some taxes tomorrow as well.
Oh, really? Yeah. You want to just go?
Yeah.
We could test.
Maybe I'll show up. Yeah.
You should. Yeah. Just come on over. I'm going to his home.
AJ is a tax wizard.
He is quite good.
I know. It's fantastic. Especially when your taxes are as messy as JW and I's.
Yeah, well, I mean, for the longest time, it was like, for me, it was all these different gigs and stuff. I was playing with four or five different orchestras and having to compile all that tax information. And then obviously there's different Pokemon revenues that come in. And yeah, this year is going to be just as bad.
Uh-huh.
And trying to take off things from, like, you know, you can count certain trips as business expenses.
Oh, yeah.
And that's really annoying to sort through. But
for me, it's the internet money. Yes, and all the different places that it comes from. It is very complicated and needs a lot. But I can write everything off, which is fantastic. Every Pokemon card that I purchase is a tax write-off.
And that's why he purchases so many.
Every single one. Yeah. Uh-huh. You know, in the beginning, AJ was like, you know, you're going to have to turn a profit 1 year, Andrew. And I'm like, well,
it's coming.
Yeah, we'll get there.
It's coming.
Yeah, we'll get there, AJ. Don't you worry about it. Yeah, are you sure this is a personal business or is this a hobby?
Well, don't they give you like 3 or 5 years or something?
They do,
right?
They do. That's why he was encouraging me. He's like, all right, like, eventually this is going to have to start looking profitable on paper, Andrew.
I could just imagine him saying that too.
Yeah. No, and it has. But for, like, you know, anytime you're starting a business,
you're gonna incur costs. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, all these cameras, everything. I mean, things were really pricey in our first few years.
And most businesses go out of business.
That's true.
Right? Isn't that like what 50% of restaurants go out of business in the first year?
Oh, heck yeah.
So
yeah,
I can't imagine what it is for Pokemon TCG streamers.
Yeah, it's probably, you know, shaky ground we're standing on. But anyways, we've got a very fun episode ahead for you all with some information that's very fresh in our minds. We just got some time to test the post-rotation temporal forces format. We're going to be doing more testing tonight. Our testing partner, Jesse Parker, is going to be joining us for some more reps in the post-rotation format as he is going to be going to the European International Championships along with me. Riley's going to be going too, but he's been a little under the weather lately, so wasn't able to join us this week. And Michael Zealy will be going. So we've got a good representation of the crew going to the European International Championships. And really the goal of this episode is to break down what are our thoughts, where does the format lay, and how similar are our experiences to what we've seen already from Japan.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think right off the bat, I just want to give kind of a groundwork for what the next format is going to look like. A lot of the same, right? There we have the Chen Paos, we have the Giratinas, we have the you know, the Lugias, the Charizards of the world. A lot of the decks that were good, thankfully for you, remain good in the next format. They maybe lose some pieces. Path to the Peak is a big loss for certain decks, and but the new cards don't make too much of an impact, and I think that's what we're seeing as we keep testing these new archetypes.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, a lot of older decks get a lot stronger with A-Specs, and I think A-Specs are going to be the big story out of Temporal Forces and how they impact some of the decks that you are already familiar with. You know, Prime Catcher, the Maximum Belt, the Hero's Cape, and seeing how all of these cards interact together And then the elephant in the room, or I guess the Snorlax in the room, mm-hmm. is Snorlax. Snorlax control. Airy, in our testing so far, has proven to be a very disruptive force in the upcoming metagame, and kind of trying to predict at an international championship, at these first big tournaments, are top players going to be sending that control deck, anticipating to catch people slipping?
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. I think you should 100% be prepared for stall if you go to Europe. I think it's in the best position that it's ever been. Airy seems like such an unfair card, just generally speaking. Now, your discard pile isn't safe. Your deck isn't safe. Your hand isn't safe. There's so many aspects of what you're trying to do on your side of the board that can be disrupted by stall. So, yeah, it's in as good a position as it's ever been. This variant of stall is, by and large, easier than other variants of stall that we've seen in past years. Just over the course of the game, I think this is one of the most straightforward stall decks, Snorlax being the key piece of that, where you can basically just win if your opponent has the wrong card in the active, just given the amount of switch cards that most decks are playing right now. So that to me is just a very big indicator that a lot of players will pick it up, even players that maybe aren't as experienced with these sorts of alternate strategies. I think they'll gravitate towards it as well.
Right. And I'm not someone who usually plays control or stall decks, but there is certainly an appeal to being able to run your opponent out of resources and kind of getting to play a different game. And I think that's really the lure of a lot of control decks or for control players, is that you're not just playing a prize race. And, you can certainly gain an edge if you're just playing a different game than your opponent is. And certainly mentally, you can say okay, well, I've got all six prizes to formulate the lock, and then once I get the lock, then we win. Mm-hmm. And it does a lot, it does a lot for your confidence. It can do a lot for your confidence, just saying I don't even have to participate in the prize race that my opponent's trying to participate in.
Totally.
I am playing a different game entirely, and one that they may not be prepared for.
Yeah, yeah. That's so true. So how much testing have you put into stall so far, Andrew?
Into stall?
Yeah.
Let's see. An entire evening.
So 10 One games?
Evening. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Probably about 8 to 10 games.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so for me it's about 20 games. And yeah, it's just really, combined with how stall is doing in this format, you're really not losing much. You're actually gaining. Again, I think one of the better cards, it's certainly in the top half of cards ever printed, Airy, you get that as an option. And so I'm really stoked for its position, and I'm excited to, I'm excited to play it tonight. But I am. Yeah,
are
I'm,
you?
I'm kind of excited. Yeah, I want that deck in my hands for sure.
Yeah. Now, kind of looking at some of the top lists from the Fukuoka Champions League, it looks like we've got, a lot of your same players. You've got four Snorlax, a Rotom, a Pidgeot. TUEX is interesting. We no longer have the Crabominable V. I think that card rotated, right? Mm-hmm. But TUEX can also attack in a pinch, if you wanted to, could Flame Surge. And I see this top placing list from the Fukuoka Champions League. Three copies of Airy.
It's gross, dude.
Three copies of Airy. I mean, that's a lot. That is a lot of hand disruption.
Yep.
And this other list, I think an interesting card that we might see pop into some lists, maybe not all, is this Mantine, right? Obviously, mm-hmm. we lose the
Echoing Horn,
which can bring threats up, bring, kind of bum Pokemon up from the discard pile into play. Without Echoing Horn, there aren't as many, there's no item or trainer-based options to bring a Pokemon from the discard pile. So you have to resort to a Pokemon-based option, but Mantine can provide that disruptive effect with its Born Ashore attack. Places a basic Pokemon from either player's discard pile onto that player's bench. Obviously, yep. In a stall deck, you're going to be choosing your opponents there.
Yeah, quite gross. I mean, these are, yeah, some of the fringe cards here. The Mantine, the Chiyu, not necessary. Certainly Chiyu can accelerate how quickly you're going through the opponent's deck. But then you just look at the core pieces, the counter catcher, the, you know, maybe even a counter stadium that you play. Maybe a Temple Sinnoh could be really good to counter things like Giratina, counter things like Lugia, maybe even Arceus that would play a Jet Energy or four. Yeah, so I mean, we look at Stahl as just having a lot of the pieces. You have TM Diva at your disposal. You have the Airy, you have Erica's Invitation. There's just a lot of pieces that work really well together. And the Rotom V, I mean, you have inbuilt draw like on the board without Path to the Peak. So yeah, a lot of things working in Stahl's favor. So if we want to take this conversation one step further, we talk about what is good against Stahl. And I think we look at decks that can repeatedly get back into the active spot, decks that play Jet Energy, I would you know, think of as being particularly strong against Stahl. So these are the Giratinas, the Lugias, and the Arceus deck. So we saw that in Japan, at least from those top 16 placements. There were three Stahl in top 16 of their big tournament a couple weeks ago, but there were also, you know, Lugia wins, Arceus was up there, Giratina was up there, all these decks that have these answers to Stahl, and they themselves also played Airy so that they could discard Stahl's counter catchers to make it even a little bit better. So it is just kind of funny how that format all worked out, and I would expect something similar heading into EUIC.
We are absolutely going to see echoes of the results from Fukuoka in EUIC. I mean, just 100%. It's one thing to like to read, and a lot of people don't read. I mean, but it's one thing. I mean, a lot of people don't. It's one thing to read the results on a page, but to experience them is something different entirely. Yeah. And some things don't really set in stone. And I know that something that Jesse's been doing really well is, and he's really been dedicating a lot of time and thought to, which is not something that necessarily every single player is doing, but Jesse's been going through like each of the top lists from Fukuoka and saying, why are they playing these cards?
Sure.
Right. And saying, why are they playing these cards? Right. Because sometimes you'll look at a list and be like, what is this doing
like,
in there?
Horrible.
That's
why
horrible.
Why is that?
You know, but actually kind of digging deeper and saying like, okay, well, what was the function? Right. Let's assume that these players and these lists are good and capable for getting to the top cut of a multiple thousand player event. Yep. Right. Obviously.
Yep.
Why are these select cards being there? And, you know, it starts to make sense with control being so gnarly. Once you actually get your hands on the decks and you realize that control is this kind of foul beast that can just absolutely decimate unprepared decks, you start to see why the Arceus and the Lugia and the Giratina decks started to make their way to the top. And being able to play cards like Airy in your Arceus deck to have that counterplay against control decks is such a funny but also, you know, very smart thing. You can Starbirth for the Airy.
Totally,
right?
Totally.
Like, and on a key turn.
Right, and I imagine that was a play that many players tried to make. Right?
Yeah.
And probably did so successfully. So, yeah, it is really, really interesting, this counterplay between some of these top decks that you're seeing in response to Stahl. I think that Airy comment that you made was a really good point. Jet Energy, I would expect to see maybe even in, like, Charizard builds. That's not anything foreign. We've certainly seen that before. So there's a lot of different things that you can do to try to give yourself an advantage. One other card that we've kind of brought up is Gengar. Brought that up in the past as being a potential option, especially for a deck that already plays a rare candy. There's a Gengar from Paldean Fates that has an ability that you can switch up any Pokemon on your bench to the active once per turn. So again, very good into the Stahl deck because you can get your attacker that they've presumably countercatchered up something else to the active, get that back attacking ASAP. That seems very good. You think about Stahl's counterplay to that as being playing a TM Devo, and just really messing with that strategy. So, geez, it's like,
but
really
that what
rough.
What a fun game ahead, though. I mean, it obviously the kind of lure and excitement of getting to play with new Pokemon EX or whatever. That's a little bit disappointing. There's not as many of like the hyper powerful cards that we've seen in sets past. There is no equivalent of Lugia V Star in this set.
Right.
There is no equivalent of Charizard EX in this set. But I think that the Temporal Forces set does a lot for the development of the game. And I've been kind of making this point and this case that the game designers do need to dial back the power level of the cards that they're making.
Yeah.
I've been making this case since the Sword and Shield block. I mean, just straight up. Since VMAXs and V-Stars, I was like, this is, it's way out of hand.
We've reached
right?
a bloat.
Yes, we've reached a bloat, and they're going to need to trim it down, trim it down, trim it down. And I think the Temporal Forces, you're seeing some of that, right? In the last few sets, they've really only introduced cards of like a certain power level, and they've been very key not to go over them. I think Charizard's one of the standouts. And then I even said this, like Gardevoir, they released Gardevoir, and this was kind of genius, right? They released Gardevoir in the first Scarlet and Violet set,
right.
And then let it fade with rotation,
right?
Right? And naturally. They were said naturally yeah. fade with losing some of the combo pieces that it relied so heavily on. So like Gardevoir was a very powerful card, but was reliant on some of its partners. And now it's like they got away with printing a new exciting card, but not printing a just silly powerful
right.
new powerful card, right? So they got to like generate excitement and hype with Gardevoir, the new Pokemon EX mechanic, without just completely blowing things wide open like they did with Pokemon VMAX
yeah.
and Pokemon V-Star
yeah.
and things like that. So the power level of the cards is reining in a little bit, but with that, you do have, you know, less exciting.
We're just in a
cards.
In a weird spot, right? Because yeah. you look at some of these EX cards, especially the basics that they seem to be pushing now, mm-hmm. right? The future archetype and the ancient archetype. I say pushing, but I mean in terms of they're pushing them through their set blocks of like these are, mm-hmm. you know, decks you can build. These are the archetypes that are within this block, but they don't really compare to the V stars, in my opinion. They're largely weaker, largely are more energy hungry. I find them to be generally just worse. But then you look again, as you're saying, like future facing, they all work really nicely together. And as a format, as we rotate these V stars, probably make for a really fun format because they've likely all been tested together against each other.
I mean, look at all these decks that we have built right here. Just for a moment, we've got Palkia V-Star is hiding right here behind
yeah,
Goldigo.
Yeah, right?
Right. Here's a V-Star. Here's a V-Star. We've got here's a V-Star.
Valuria.
It's hiding behind Chinchino.
Right.
That's a V-Star.
Right.
Right. So the V-Stars are still, and there's Arceus. We don't have Arceus built, but Arceus is a top contender in this format. So All of the best V stars from the end of the Sword and Shield block, Arceus, Palkia,
yeah.
Giratina, and Lugia are all still major players in
yeah.
the metagame,
totally.
Right?
Totally.
All of them,
totally.
And they have not faded one bit
from
the spotlight
yeah,
or the relevance or
yeah.
relevance, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's going to take a lot for. I mean, it's going to take rotation, I think, for those cards to leave, much like Mew VMAX before it, and. And I think that that's fine. It's going to take some time, but the game will heal and get better because of it. You know, I'm not upset that the game designers kind of took those directions with their cards and tried new, you know, powerful things. It's just like I'm happy to see them dialing it back.
Yeah.
So while some players might be disappointed, the whole point of this is to say that while some players might be disappointed that Temporal Forces, the new poster Pokemon from Temporal Forces, aren't beating it up like some of the old big powerful Pokemon V-Stars, you don't actually want that. And here's why, right?
You
know, it's kind of the case that I'm making. You want to see this dial back in power level because when we do get a dial back in power level, that means that in the next handful of years, more decks are going to be viable, not less.
Yeah.
So then, you
yeah,
know.
Yeah, or yeah, certainly, certainly.
More decks will be able to attain the kind of the power level of the format
sure.
than previously, which is like, okay, there's this level, which not a lot of other Pokemon can reach.
Yeah, sure. Well, it is interesting, though, because there are probably about 10 decks, and this is what I've been telling players that have been you know, testing in this format. It's like, to be honest, dude, there's about 10 decks that I could imagine at a UIC, you know, certainly making top 8, winning the whole tournament. And
yeah.
it's very reasonable, like with given the right metagame, given the right preparation in terms of list, like there's a lot of viable archetypes. It's really hard on the one hand to counter and metagame for what you might expect to see because there are so many good archetypes. But there's something also to be said for choosing one and then just like maining that.
Yeah.
And really becoming knowledgeable about all the intricacies of how you play different matchups and then maybe even adapting your deck in unconventional ways. We brought up the Airy in the Arceus decks. That's only something you figure out after you play enough games against Stahl or against, you know, Charizard, right? You could airy away the rare candies in those matchups or something, you know, there, you only get that knowledge by just like taking that deck and really identifying some of the weaknesses that, you know, that are in other decks.
And I feel like that's something that I've been kind of missing with myself lately. I mean, I know that I'm a player who benefits from repetition and really learning a deck and having that. And I definitely, in the year past, I had that with Mew, but then I moved on to Maridon, and then I kind of fell out of favor with Maridon. And that, and since then, I've been kind of just looking for the next thing to grasp onto. But you certainly have these players who are very successful and have kind of just stayed true to their deck and have reaped the benefits of that. I mean, look at Jared Grimes has earned an entire invite with 10 POW EX.
Look at Tord.
Tord.
You know, right? That's another big one with Gardy, right? Yep. Just playing that forever.
Or or James with Gardy, right?
Yeah, or James with Gardy.
Yeah, James
or,
Cox.
Or,
yeah.
Vince Kelly with Mew. I mean, there's a lot
Vince
of examples.
Vince Kelly with Mew.
Yep.
There's a lot of examples of players who are kind of just like really dialing into the decks that they like to play. Like if you asked me, what's Makani Tron going to play post-rotation? It's Arceus time, baby.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, like, he's the Arceus guy. Like, you're telling me he's not gonna show up and play Gardy? Like, of course, or show up and play Arceus? Of course he's going to show up and play Arceus. And he's going to have probably the gnarliest Arceus brew with all the different cards that are there just for the right reasons, right?
Right.
And there's something to be said for that. It really does feel like it's a format where you can, and I've been saying this for a little while, you can play your favorite deck. Play your favorite, of the best ones, pick your favorite and just learn it really well.
Play it perfectly.
Yeah, and play it perfectly. Yeah. That's going to set you up for the best amount of success.
Yeah, certainly.
And I
certainly.
Think even in our games today, we felt a little bit of that. It felt like even in a bad matchup like Charizard versus Chen Pao, there's room for counterplay.
Yeah.
And if you tweak like a card or two here or there, and if you make like the really correct decision on, you know, turn two, turn three, about what you're promoting, what you're setting up your board to be like, when you're using your rods and things like that, you can, you know, increase the percentages so that you're going to win.
Yep,
and totally. And over the course of a tournament, you can steal some wins that you maybe otherwise wouldn't have had.
Yeah, so I think that's a good point. I think that's a good pivot into kind of a matchup by matchup, like what we've actually tested and what we see as being, you know, the format moving forward. Now, I personally think, again, the big three for me seem to be Giratina as just the overall kind of solid deck, right? If you're not looking to lose to anything, but you're not looking to like, you know, you're looking to give yourself the most 50-50 matchups, it seems like Giratina is there, always has really good options with all the one prizes that you have while still maintaining that one-shot option with the Giratina. And then you have your best deck that attacking two prize deck. I think of that as being Chen Pao. That deck to me has really stood out. I've played it for, you know, in the post-rotation format for now about the last month, just testing by myself, testing with Jesse, or playing against anyone that I coach. And so Chen Pao feels like the best two prize attacking deck. And then you have Stahl, which kind of rounds it out, which is going to beat your Chen Pao, but lose to your Giratina, and, you know, has, again, roughly solid matchups in the metagame as a whole. So that, to me, feels like the core three for this metagame moving into EUIC. I would expect those to be, like, three of the top five. I sprinkle in some Charizard, maybe some, you know, Future Box or something. I don't know what random deck people will pick up for EUIC, but I'm curious your thoughts, Andrew. Like, what is standing out to you from this format as you've been testing?
Yeah, I immediately, my first thoughts of the format are that I without Path to the Peak gone, I wanted to play a one hit KO deck. You know, I wanted to play your Golden Goes or your Chen Pao's. And after getting my hands on with Golden Go and Chen Pao, each deck has its own strengths and weaknesses. I think it's worth noting that neither deck finished in the top 16 of the Fukuoka Champions League. So part of our testing has been figuring out why. Like, why were these decks not represented? I mean, it's not because they weren't popular. These decks were popular in Japan. But why did they not convert into the top 16 of the Fukuoka Champions League? And so I was curious. And I think that of the two, Golden Go and Chen Pao, I like Golden Go more, and that's kind of just my personal biases, but I think Chen Pao's better. So, like,
I agree.
Chen Pao's better, and the difference maker is that Chen Pao can play the single prize game where Golden Go cannot.
Totally.
And Chen Pao can play the Iron Hands game where Golden Go cannot. Yep. And Golden Go does have other strengths that Chen Pao does not. I mean, you could build a solid board state with a bunch of 260 hit point Pokemon, which are just kind of annoying to deal with. You have each of your dudes has built-in draw power, and you can just end up with a very large hand, which is something that Chen Pao can never do, really. I mean, it never really has a hand that's this big. Radiant Greninja, maybe, but usually it's much smaller. You know, a Golden Go hand can end up with a much larger hand size. So, and Golden Go plays into the new Cypher Maniacs code breaking. Mm-hmm. Kind of plays into that card perfectly in that your main attacker draws two cards. But I do think that, you know, after playing both decks, I think that I have to concede that I think Chen Pao Baxcalibur is a little bit better. And that there are a few things that I feel like really help the deck, namely Avery being gone is just such a huge boost. I mean, it's like a little thing, but it makes a huge difference. Now that you can safely set up, get two Bibarel, I can get two Baxcalibur.
Yeah,
going,
not really think about it.
And I don't have to worry about Avery Prime Catcher.
Yeah,
or Avery Countercatcher, which are the kinds of things that are going to be happening all the time. It used to be much easier to pick apart a Baxcalibur's board than it is nowadays without that Avery. So I do agree. I think Chen Pao is very strong, but I like the decks that I really think highly of. I think Control is kind of like enemy number one. I would say that's like, I consider it to be the best deck in the format, and the deck that needs to be respected the most. Something that we haven't really touched on is the fact that, like, yeah, your Tina decks can counter control decks with Jet Energy, but control decks are playing four Temple of Sinnoh.
Three to four
Temple of Sinnoh.
Sure.
Like, that's not even, the Jet's not like an auto in. They're already, the control decks are adapting. And really, the Fukuoka results now are months or weeks old. So the control players now, that was in like almost a blind metagame.
Right.
Now the control players have more defined. They're like, okay, here are the results. We need to beat that. And now they can take that information and make sure that their decks are constructed specifically. So that's scary to me.
That was really scary.
Is that they have those top lists. So if you're playing one of those top lists as is, the control players are already there and aiming to beat it.
And the counterplay there is that without Path in the format, generally decks don't need to play a lot of stadiums, except for Control, right? Because Control has the space to play those four stadiums if they so choose for Temple of Sinnoh. But a lot of decks just generally wouldn't want to play stadiums in a format without Path. Like, those clunk up in your hand, those clunk up in your deck. It's not really something that you necessarily need in any given game. And so, you know, we saw four copies of Stadium in the prior format because we had Path, and there were certain decks like a Chen Pao that would really like to not be Path every single turn. You had decks like, of course, Lugia that doesn't want to be Path every single turn. But now looking into this new format, what's the big stadium that you want to counter? I mean, for generally speaking, nothing, unless you're playing against all, and they have the Temple of Sinnoh.
Yeah, and I think I still think very highly of Charizard. I think that Charizard will occupy a similar space, if not a more prevalent space than what it did in the previous format. And if you take a look at the city leagues from around Japan, Charizard is the winningest deck. When you combine all the different variants, I mean, you've got Charizard Bibarel, you got Charizard Pidgeot. Charizard is still the winningest deck from Japan. And I think that it can be outfitted to defeat whatever the top threats are. And as a Charizard deck, you have a lot of room to play with. You really do. I mean, your attacker is just Charizard. It accelerates to itself.
Sure.
You can outfit the Charizard deck with whatever support you want and whatever techs you want. And there is enough space to accommodate for that, especially, you know, getting cards like Prime Catcher, just so good, giving you like a switch and a gust in one. I mean, really, Charizard wants to play like one switch. Now you don't even really have to. You just can play the Prime Catcher, which is also a gust. So like, that's a nice space saver in your deck construction. And I think that Charizard will continue to be a dominant force in the metagame. I actually put Charizard well over Giratina in my own personal.
Man,
which
that's
is something where
that's
we
so
differ.
Interesting because yeah, I really am not that excited about Charizard. I think it's a fine deck. I think it should probably occupy a top five spot in terms of how played it is, but I don't view it as being.
I got it in a top three spot.
I don't view it as being a deck that can win a tournament. I mean, I don't think it'll, like, the bold prediction that I have would be it won't make top eight at EUIC.
Really?
Yeah.
That is bold.
That is bold.
That
so
is bold.
I'm going to be willing to eat my words later, but I just don't view it as, you know, you look at, again, attacking decks. Chen Pao, I think, is way better. Stall is going to beat Charizard most of the time, unless you're, like, heavily teching for it. And then in that case, you're a stage two deck that's, like, trying to tech for a matchup that's maybe only 5% of the field, and you may not even beat it then because they might play a counter to what you're trying to do. You know, we talk about the Gengar, and they play, you know, a TM Devo or something. You know, there are ways that they can get around it too, right? And so I don't know, man. I think there is a reason that Charizard would be played. I think it's a comfort pick for a lot of players, and looking into maybe a blind format where players haven't really tested a lot, sure, they might gravitate towards a Charizard deck, but I don't see it as being, you know, better than Chen Pao in terms of attacking. I don't see it as having more advantages. Certainly, like, as a one prize attacking deck, as like a deck like Giratina, it doesn't have that obscene power level from the early game as a deck like Lugia. Even I just don't think that Charizard has a ton of advantages. And I think it's going to get eaten up by this, you know, kind of metagame that I would predict in EUIC.
You know what my favorite counter is, JW?
Let's hear it.
A counter to all that unruly body hair.
Yes.
That you can get from Manscaped products.
Absolutely. Manscaped is the premier men's grooming products company. They have all the things that you need to keep everything nice and trim down there. So, man, the Lawnmower 5.0 is one that comes to mind that both Andrew, I, and Riley use on a weekly basis to make sure that our beard hair... No, I'm just kidding. No beard hair for us. But our
really,
I
use that trimmer specifically for my underparts.
Yes, absolutely.
Uh-huh. I don't go down that.
Don't need it.
I got a separate routine for my face.
Yep. Exactly. So, why don't you tell them, Andrew, where they can find their Manscaped products?
You can go to manscaped.com and find all of Manscaped men's grooming products there. They've got some fantastic stuff to check out. I am personally privy to the nose hair trimmer and the lawnmower 5.0. Those are ones that I use in my daily grooming routine. And manscaped.com is where you're going to want to go to check those out. You can use code TAGTEAM at checkout to receive 20% off your order and free shipping.
Yeah, pretty cool. Head on over to manscaped.com. 20% off plus free shipping with code TAGTEAM at checkout. Thank you so much to Manscaped for sponsoring the cast.
That's right.
So, yeah, I mean, so where does that leave us then?
Where does that leave us? I think that I've named two of my top three decks. I think Charizard and Stall. And then number three, I guess I'm going to have to agree that Chen Pao, I think, is there. I think that it has that one-hit KO potential that I really like. It has the Iron Hands. I think it's the best Iron Hands deck in
the
format.
Iron Hands abuser.
After playing some with the Turbo Hands deck, which is kind of where, like, Maridon has ended up. It's funny because Maridon EX isn't in the Turbo Hands deck, but it feels like since it's playing Electric Generator, the Turbo Hands deck, and since it has hands in it, like, that is kind of what the Maridon deck is.
The spiritual successor.
To Maridon has kind of evolved into future Turbo Hands, right?
Yeah.
Which, you know, may not feel great for Maridon fans out there, because it does kind of feel like that good old trusty deck is gone. I'm not sure that Roaring Moon really survives without them. You know, in its old kind of status as like a big basic turbo, big basic deck, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think Roaring Moon really kind of survives without its Galarian Moltres V. I mean, that card just brought so much to it, right?
Yeah, it sure did. Yeah, I think you look at Roaring Moon sadly as a deck that I don't really consider a top contender. Again, Could be wrong. Very open to being wrong. It's a new metagame. Certainly, results from Japan can tell you something, but they can't tell you everything.
Right.
And, you know, we'll have just have to see how things evolve from there. But I would agree, Roaring Moon seems like it loses a step now that you can't really focus at all on the research type build. And you have to really play those Sadas to try to get energy in play. And without the Moltres, just makes things really tough for that deck. I think other decks that are really, the one deck that surprised me today from our testing was Lugia. We played Lugia against Giratina. And that's just so difficult for Giratina to win because you have the Mist Energy, which prevents the Sableye. And the V-Star attack, man. And the V-Guard attack, you can't even do 280 to knock out a Lugia
when
V-Star.
You have a board filled with like Mist Energies and a V-Guard on the right thing and there's Snorlax that can't be
it's
damaged
gross.
By
it's just disgusting. There was a time where you had four Pokemon in play and none of them could be either V-Starred or Sableye because they all had the right energy on them, and it was just disgusting. Absolutely horrific matchup in my opinion for Giratina. So that's something that I look at. How big do you think Lugia will be? Because coming into today, and we only played three games of Lugia, but I had played some more in my testing, but coming into today, I had just said Lugia is pretty weak. I give it a lot of credit for being that deck that can handily beat Giratina. At least, again, from the three games that we played, you won two with your
and
Lugia
I was
deck,
playing
and I
sloppy.
You were playing sloppy. That first game was pretty funny.
Imagine you put that in a capable Lugia player's hands. They're chilling.
Yeah, they are chilling. Yeah, for sure. But I mean, where do you feel Lugia is right now?
It's interesting because Lugia obviously won the Fukuoka Champions League. So, yeah, I mean, like, why aren't we talking about it more? Why isn't Lugia a top three deck for either of us? And I do consider Lugia a top five deck. In fact, I think it's like fourth. I think it's like right there. And I know I kind of think a little more highly of Lugia than you do. And I had that testing session with Michael Zealy last week. And I mean, he started off the night by playing Lugia and was just giving me the hands with it. I mean, I was playing Chen Pao. I was playing Golden Go. I was playing some of my favorite decks. And Lugia just kept setting up consistently. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is third game in a row. You've got a turn two double Archeops. Right. Like, this is ridiculous.
Right.
Actually, I was like, okay, all right. Like, something's going on.
You can
on
stop
here.
Now.
Yes, yeah. Please, a turn two double Archeops, three games in a row. But then, like, as the night went on, it was like, you know, maybe he only bricked, like, one out of six games or something. And I was like, okay, well, Lugia is a scary deck. Like, if it gets set up, and I think that we were seeing that, if Lugia sets up quickly, it is one of the scariest decks in the format.
Well, so, okay, I just, my question is, you know, and again, we talked early in the cast about how a lot of decks carry over into the new format. So why is Lugia good now when it wasn't last format?
Chinchino. Path. Yeah.
Okay.
Chinchino and Path. Yeah. I mean, so like, before, I mean, Lugia did fade, right? So if it faded, why is it now getting a spark, right? Like, why is it coming back? In fact, it took a hit. It doesn't even have Professor Burnett anymore, right? And why is it making a comeback now? I mean, it gains a certain number of things. It gains Mist Energy, which is huge for
it. That is pretty big.
Right? So Mist Energy is crazy. Mist Energy prevents all effects of attacks done to the Pokemon it's attached to. So, I mean, that's no Star Requiem with Giratina V-Star. That's no Lost Mine with Sableye. And that's pretty huge. And then the fact that you've also got this, like, absolutely ridiculous one-hit KO potential with Chinchino means that Chinchino can threaten even Charizard EX. I mean, in one turn, you can power four energy onto it with two Archeops, attach from hand, and that is five energy.
350.
Take a big knockout. Yeah. We've also got a comment in chat here saying that, you know, Maridon's not 10 to 15% of the metagame anymore, which is true. And if we think that if this Turbo Hands deck is really as bad as we kind of think it is,
it's not good, dude.
And I don't think it's very good.
It's not good.
Then are there any real lightning threats that Lugia is even worrying about?
Yeah.
I think it's kind of this, it's just this kind of consistent deck that's not terribly difficult to play and can set up some really gnarly board states that just kind of play off the board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a good point. I didn't really consider the Cinchino all that much. And that kind of comes back to the testing that I had personally, where I got these turn one hands where I'd have to prioritize, of course, getting out the Lugia and getting the Archaops into the discard pile. And all of a sudden it felt like a couple turns went by and I wasn't really putting on any pressure with my one prizers because I couldn't find them, because I couldn't get them down. I wasn't drawing into the Nest Balls. I wasn't drawing into the Ultra Balls. And it just felt like a very lackluster deck when you're attacking with a Lugia. That's just not where you want to be, because you're not one-shotting things, especially if you attach a double turbo. You're not even one-shotting the unevolved Vs. And it just got really hairy and really bad for me.
And that's what I think that, I mean, I kind of had similar, and I had to check myself because I kind of had similar feelings about Lugia last format. I mean, but back when it was like a good respected deck, I mean, like the single strike version, right? I mean, and I say good respected deck, and it always kind of had a stigma of being inconsistent and kind of a pile. But there were some really good players who still, good players who I respect, you know, and thought very highly of, who still continued to jam Lugia even through all of that and continue to do well with it. So you kind of have to look like, okay, well, what are they seeing that I'm not seeing? Like, and once you really kind of watch some good players play out of tough situations, just with some real heads up play, knowing the deck inside and out, saying like, I know how to play a game without the optimal turn one hand. So long as I can get into the mix, I know all of the routes, and I know how to mount a comeback. Like, there's something to be said for that. I think, like, Lugia V-Star arguably has the strongest V-Star power in the game, combined with Archaops. Sure. The board state of double Archaops is one of the strongest.
It's crazy.
One of the strongest turn two board states that you can produce.
Ever. Of all time.
Of all time.
Yeah.
Right?
Of all time.
So, like, that might not be a board state that you're able to concoct turn two every game, but if you can get it by turn three,
that's fine.
That's fine.
Especially now with the one prizers. That's really interesting. I would like to run Lugia a little bit more, but again, like, from what we've played today, I'm more open to it than I would have been you know, a couple weeks ago, where it's just like, I was really struggling. I don't feel that the Pau matchup is particularly good. And again, I'm really like high on Chen Pau. So that might be just personal bias, where Lugia into the field is very good, maybe doesn't have the best Chen Pao matchup. And so, you know, I'm looking at it through this lens of like, you know, Giratina, Chen Pao, Stall as being the big archetype. So you got to have answers to that. And I just felt Lugia was really nowhere close to having answers to what Chen Pao could do, considering you can iron hands relatively easy. You're trading a lot better than them for the most part. So that's kind of where I was at.
So let's talk about, and I feel like so my top three decks, and I think like kind of my top, Let's break it down to top five. I mean, I think like my top deck is Stall. I think then I have Charizard, and you know what? I'll put Lugia there. Well, I'll say I think I got Snorlax, I got Charizard, I got Lugia. It won Fukuoka. There's something going on there. It's got a good Stall matchup, right? Mm-hmm. And then Chen Pao, and five, I would put, I mean, like Arceus, you know, something like that would round out my top five. And maybe a couple of those get juggled around. But I think that those five are the five decks that I would want to have in my top five. And I think like right below, you got like your Lost Box variants, I think, are all kind of hovering around like right outside of there. But I don't necessarily like Lost Box isn't a deck that is it seemed fine to me, but it hasn't like made me be like, wow, that's the
deck. I think Lost Box is pretty good.
Yeah.
I think Lost Box.
It seems fine to me.
I think it's a top five deck. Yeah. I mean, Paradox Lost Box, I think, is the, you know, most accepted Lost Box variant at this point. And so that feels very real. You know, being able to get a hands play, being able to get a Roaring Moon play and just one shot anything on the opponent's side of the field. I mean, these are very strong combos that you can piece together with that Lost Box deck. And I think that is very real. So that's certainly in my top five, probably at the fifth spot. I would go probably five Lost Box general, favoring Paradox based Lost Box, and then Arceus at four. Then you have your Giratina, Stall at two, and again Chen Pao, I think, just has so many good answers to a lot of the best decks aside from Stall.
So then I think the next thing to talk about, and it's like both of our top fives have a lot of old decks revamped with new ideas. So let's talk about, and I think there are, I mean, we were saying, I think there are like 10 decks that could reasonably win.
Yeah.
And I think that the metagame is in a point where, you know, there are some outlier decks that could spike and really show up. So let's take some time to talk about those. First and foremost, we haven't spent any time talking about the ancient Dino Box kind of archetype. You've gotten your hands on it a little bit. You've played it a little bit. I've played it a little bit. What are your thoughts on the Dino Box? What's good about it? What's bad about it?
Yeah, I think it's actually the best one prize deck. So it just seems very metagame specific. If you're facing a lot of Lost Box decks, if you're facing a lot of one prize focused archetypes, then that's where the deck can really succeed. Or actually Chen Pao. It actually does have a pretty solid Chen Pao matchup considering how much HP these one prize attackers have. But you look beyond that, there's not a lot to love. There's a lot of other decks that can go with one prizers and kind of match there, or they just have too much HP. They are not able to one-shot yourself because you're trying to build up for that big Roaring Moon towards the end of the game to knock out the V-Stars. But you look at a lot of those V-Stars, having 280, you have to sequence everything just right and be a little bit lucky to get, 22 cards in the loss or in the discard pile to take the one-shot. So that to me is where it occupies. It's the best one prize deck, but considering a lot of the other decks on the table are all two prize or V star focused, doesn't really do so well into those style of decks with those, you know, more HP.
For me, it's I kind of conceptually like where it's headed and what it's trying to do. Like, I like the idea of it. I really like a single prize deck. I like a single prize deck that can take big one hit KOs. I've compared it to Reggie's in that it kind of feels like Reggie's in some ways, in that it's got these beefy single prizers that do a medium amount of damage and hit a select couple things for weakness, right? So like that's that it, and it has like the ability to take one hit KO sometimes.
Right.
So that's almost exactly what you're dealing with, right? But that it also is like Reggie's in that it feels kind of, you know, temperamental at times and can just get into some really awkward positions where it feels like you can't do anything. I think for me, my biggest beef with the Dino Box deck, and this extends to a lot of the ancient cards, is that I don't like Sada's Vitality as
horrible
an engine.
Draw.
I don't like it.
It's terrible.
I do not like it.
Because you need it to attack, and then you also need it for the draw effect. Right? Like, it's like a two-piecer, where if you miss it early, you're not only not drawing cards, you're not attacking. Like, it just, it's compounds on itself to the point that if you're not finding it on those turns that you need it, especially in that early game, you're not really putting on any pressure, which is what you need to be doing with that style of deck, because you need to take that advantage of, okay, I'm going to smack you early and often. I may have weaker attacks. I may have less HP overall, but I'm at least going to put on consistent pressure. And if you don't find Sada early, you're dead in the water.
Yeah. And I think that, think about the formats past where we had the closest point of comparison are like the Welder formats, right? I mean, where like you had these decks that just played for Welder. Those formats had Jirachi from Team Up. Those formats had Dedenne GX. I mean, you had this explosive draw to go find, like forcibly find your Welders, almost, it felt like. Whereas,
well, and From the Hand is much different because you also had
the Giant Hearth.
Giant Hearth, right? Yeah. And you just pull it to hand. So there's another piece involved where you got to get those energy to the discard pile. And that can be difficult in and of itself.
Right. Because if you just opened, you know, Welder to Fire, like,
you're chilling.
Here we go. Yeah. But it feels different and it feels complex. I mean, Melanie Dex did see success. Obviously, it accelerates one energy from the discard pile to a Pokemon V and draws three cards. Sada should just be better. Yeah, and no. I think that Melanie saw a lot of success, not as like a four of nothing else kind of, you know, supporter. No. It saw success as like, oh, here's a couple. Use it in your Arceus deck to help get an extra attachment. Use it with Drizzile and Inteleon to go search it on the turn you need it for your Palkia deck or whatever. But these Sada decks are incredibly different. I mean, they are just kind of like, I have the Sada, that's my draw card and my acceleration, and I better have it when I need it. And then the Dino Box deck is playing Sada and the Explorer's Guidance, which also does not impress me at all. As a supporter card, you know, look at the top six, keep two. Like,
I know Hapu was not good.
Hapu zero play.
No, that's not true. That's not true. It was like sometimes a one of.
So marginal. So
it was like sometimes a one of in like Malamar decks, right? Very specific. They wanted energy in the discard pile. Sure, there's arguments to play, you know, Hapu or Explorer's Discovery. But having that, relying on an effect like that, a supporter like that, that's really tough. That is really, really tough.
It is. I mean, so then you've got this like double-edged sword of like, your two supporters that you are encouraged to play. I don't say you have to play them. You don't have to play them. You could play Research, but then you're going to have less cards in the discard pile for your Roaring Moon, who you want to be doing, you know, close to 300 damage. If you want to play into the Roaring Moon strategy, you have to play, which is get as many ancient cards in the discard pile as you can to boost its Vengeance Feathers attack or whatever it got translated to. If you want to play into that, you got to play as many ancient cards as possible, which means that you have to play the two ancient supporters that exist, Explorer's Guidance and Sada. And I happen to be a fan of neither. So I'm in this weird spot with Dinobox where I kind of like and respect what the deck is trying to do, but I don't love the way it's trying to do it.
Yeah, it's the best one prize deck, which is ironic because it's just not playable right now, in my opinion. And again,
I wouldn't go that far.
Open to being wrong on that. Yeah. But the space that it occupies and what I've seen from the deck is that it's very exploitable. You need to have the Sadas on the turn that you need them. And if you miss them, you're not putting on pressure. And the deck just needs to be attacking every single turn. If you can't do that, you lose, pretty much, from what I've seen. Maybe there are other people that have other experiences with that. But it's also the same for the Future deck, which is kind of interesting. You need to put on that early pressure. We're talking about the Hands deck. Hands has now risen to about $15 a card, which is crazy to me. But the Future deck with the Iron Leaves, what, Iron Leaves?
Is it
Iron
you just Leaves? Said Iron Hands.
No, it's the Iron Hands. What's the booster?
Oh, the guy on the bench. The Iron Crown.
Iron Crown, sorry. Yeah, the Iron Crown.
The Kabalion.
Yes, the Kabalion, yes. And so you can, you know, really put on aggressive pressure in the early game and take those two prizes off of maybe your opponent they're trying to set up as they try to set up there. I think that deck also suffers from a lot of what Dinobox suffers with, which is if you can't put on that early pressure, then your opponent's just going to pick apart your board. And you may be trying to accelerate to an Iron Hands, but the Chen Pao deck is going to find their boss or they're going to find the Prime Catcher and just gust and knock it out. And it just makes it really hard. I find that deck, both of those decks, Future and Ancient Box, to really suffer from a lot of that. You know, they just can't put on enough early game regression.
Yeah, I was really excited for the Future Box deck. Very excited for the Future Box deck. I think that the Future Box deck does a very good job of getting the turn one attack. That's the one thing it does really well.
Well, but on a Maraidon.
Yes. It does a really good job. Okay. Well, it does a really good job of doing 100 damage turn one. It does. I mean, which is something that like Lost Box decks can all do. But that's kind of... That is... Exactly. I mean, that's something that Lost Box decks can do. And Lost Box decks can do 110 damage with Spit Innocently turn one without a bunch of, you know, low HP two prizers on the bench. And in a format with Countercatcher and Prime Catcher and lots of big mean guys that can take big one-hit KOs on two prizers, the Future Box deck feels like it very quickly gets outpaced and outpowered by a lot of the format. When you go in with Maraidon turn one, even if you do take a knockout on a Pidgey or a Charmander or something like that, your opponent can just evolve up into Charizard, gust up the two prizer. It could gust up whichever guy you powered up and knock it out, and then you could be in a really tough spot. It does feel like playing the Future Box deck that you're constantly projecting exactly where you're going and hoping that your opponent doesn't gust it up and ruin your day.
Sure.
That's just what it feels like
or
to play that deck.
Lost Vacuum.
Or Lost Vacuum, your Heavy Baton. And I kind of am saying that outside of just the Turbo Hands variant, but like kind of all of the Future Toolbox decks, they feel like they're just in like a weird spot with their energy. I think the Maraidon is my favorite part of the deck. Getting a quick attack with the Maraidon, accelerating energy into play, that's my favorite part.
Yeah.
But then like where does it go in the mid game? I feel like the future box kind of loses the plot of like what it's trying to do.
Yeah, sure.
And
sure.
Like, what does it do better than every other deck in the format?
Sure.
Does it get the best turn one attack in the format? No, not really. That's probably still Cramorant, right? Does it get the best end game comeback potential in the format? Definitely not. No, it's not doing that either. Is it the best mid game in the format? No, it doesn't have the best mid game. So like, what is it doing better than every other deck? And I think that what's kind of baked into the future deck DNA is that it's kind of served up as a counterbox style deck, right? That you've got all these different types of Pokemon that you can play. You've got the fighting guy, you've got the metal guy, you've got the lightning guy, you know, you've got the fire guy, and you're encouraged to play all these different types of energy. You got the grass guy. You're encouraged to play all these different types of energy that Maridon can accelerate into play and then capitalize by hitting your opponent for weakness.
Yep.
It just feels like that is maybe not the best strategy right now.
It really isn't.
But that is what the deck does.
Because the metagame is so wide.
Yeah.
I mean, it comes back to that, right? It's like you're not going to be able to account for every deck that you want to account for, because in a 9-round tournament, you might hit 9 different decks. And that's very reasonable to expect. And so I think that's where, you know, you're saying hitting for weakness, sure, can be good in a very narrow metagame. If you're trying to account for everything in the format, and you need to account for everything in the format because that's how the deck is made, you're going to struggle a lot with just a tournament setting where you're playing a wide variety of decks. I completely agree with you there.
Yeah, and it feels like as far as your big basic decks go, yeah. I mean, because that's kind of what the future box deck is. Right. Do any of those dudes evolve? Future and Ancients are all basics.
They're all basics,
yeah. So they're both going to be classified as big basic decks, right? And as far as being a big basic deck goes, the Ancients do it better because they're bigger. They can wear the Ancient booster energy capsule and just make themselves actually big basics, right? Whereas like when you're playing the future box deck, it's huge, like, dang, dudes. I got all these 220 hit point guys that are just waiting to get eaten alive. Yeah. But when you're playing the Ancient deck, at least you can put Ancient booster energy capsule on these things and make your Koridon have 200 hit points, you know, mm-hmm. make your sure. Roaring Moon, single prize Roaring Moon, have 200 hit points. Sure. If you were playing Roaring Moon EX, you put an Ancient booster energy capsule on that, you can make it have 290 hit points. I mean, just like an obscene amount of HP, which can make it, you know, actually just tough to mm-hmm. deal with.
Yep.
Because it's a basic with dang near 300 hit points.
Right.
But the future deck can't do that. And I think that that's like a big... that's a big kind of L for the future deck to hold.
Yeah, so I mean, we don't really see those as being big contenders. Is there anything else from the next set that you really see as being viable? I mean, we haven't really talked about Arceus. I know that's not from the new set, but that's a deck that I see as being, you know, it's certainly a top 10 deck. Wouldn't be surprised to see it make top 8 or win. A couple different variants there that I think you could classify in different ways. But in terms of, yeah, other archetypes that we haven't talked about, is there anything that really piques your interest, even if it's just things that you want to test that you haven't gotten a chance to?
Yeah, so the obviously we haven't spent a lot of time on Arceus. We probably, you know, and we should, and I think we're going to do more testing with it tonight. There's the Alolan Vulpix V-Star and the Giratina V-Star variants, and you know, Arceus just isn't a deck that kind of revs my engines and gets me going.
Yeah, but you don't need to be, I mean, it's yeah. consistent, right? You don't need to have
fancy
plays.
You definitely don't see Arceus Duraludon from formats past. I mean, but that's, it feels like it occupies a very similar space that it always has, and yeah. it just will continue to be aight. So, you know, if you're interested in the top Arceus list, go on to limitless.com and check out the latest Arceus list. They aren't terribly exciting, but they are there. And they are pretty good, and they've got a pretty good stall matchup.
Yep.
Other cards that I am interested in from Temporal Forces, I mean, I like Matang, and I think that Dialga V-Star is like a relatively powerful card. I wouldn't be totally blown away, surprised if somebody was able to cook with that.
What stopped you from playing it? Because you were playing it on the stream. You know, when we were here last, there was one time you were playing it on stream, and I was like, wow, I was really impressed with it.
It's kind of cool.
I think we played it.
Yeah, I think it's kind of cool. Well, at this point, it's like I guess I'm trying to figure out, you know, what the top decks are and make sure that I'm familiar enough with those. And then, like, once I kind of get my mind wrapped around what I expect the format to be, then I can start constructing decks that I think that are going to beat those decks, right? Okay. So right now, I don't consider Matang Diaga to be a part of, like, the format. Right now, I feel like this is more or less the format with, like, you know, no Gouging Fire, but put in, like, Arceus and, like, Control, right? But I feel like what we have here on the table is pretty much the format. So I'm trying to wrap my head around this. And then once we kind of have our minds wrapped around this, then we kind of can do
branch out
a little bit and figure out, okay, well, this is the format. How do we capitalize on that? How do we come out on top? The Diaga V-Star deck is, I think it's kind of cool. Diaga V-Star has seen success before. It has been proven that if you can get a turn two V-Star, you could beat a lot of decks.
Yeah, that seems like a good rogue option, right? In terms of, I haven't seen anything that really piques my interest in terms of rogue options as much as Diaga does. Because like you said, it does have track record a couple formats ago. You are getting this just really incredible accelerator in the form of Matang, and putting those cards to the bottom means you don't draw into them. That can be really strong as well. And if you're able to chain a couple of those abilities on the Matang, you know, you're really digging 8, 12, maybe even 16 cards into your deck to find these energies. It's quite strong from a, you know, card design perspective. So yeah, that one's an interesting one to me. I think Diaga has a lot of potential.
I think so too. Anything else you want to touch on before we head out for the day, JW?
Oh, man.
I think we've had a great content day
so.
Today. What a great content
and
day.
Maybe we'll have a great testing evening. Maybe even a dinner.
I mean, I'm getting a little hungry.
Me too. My belly is rumbling.
All right. I think that's going to do it for us today. Thank you so much for watching the stream and the cast. We're going to get this uploaded where all, you know, I don't know, podcasts live. Where is that, JW?
That's going to be on Spotify. That's where we upload, but then it goes, you know, Spotify, Google, Anchor, the other platforms that it all just does it manually. So I just upload it one place and it goes everywhere. So.
Wow, really?
Yeah, dude.
That's cool, man.
Yeah, so I don't even know. Stitcher.
I'm just here, bro.
Apple.
I don't know how any of this works.
So anyway, if you want to get more plugged into the Tag Team ecosystem, you can find us on the X platform at Tag Team Pokemon. You can find Andrew at Enjoy Friend and myself at Real John Walter, and of course Riley Hulbert, who's not with us here today, at Smiles with Riles. That will do it for today's cast. We thank you all so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week.
See ya.